This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. This is a part of the program which we call the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. You know, if you've been following the Big Picture and our ongoing series and the experts that we have here on the program, we all tend to believe that we're in the late stages of a business cycle. You're well aware that the Fed has been behind all recessions and bear markets when they begin to tighten monetary policy, basically by withdrawing liquidity from the financial markets. And so that means that we are headed toward some kind of a financial storm, because the Fed's track record has been to keep raising rates until something goes kerplooey. So when it goes kerplooey, when recession comes back in, what will the storm look like? Will it be a Category 5 crash like in 2007 to 2009? How about a Category 3 like 2000 or 2002, or maybe something a little milder than that, a Category 2 like 1991? And so the question is now, when the storm arrives, what will it look like? And to answer that question, we have to ask the following. What are the financial barometers looking like on the financial storm fronts? And what's the color Doppler financial radar showing right now?
You know, it's interesting, John, because when we look at the financial crisis, you just mentioned the last three recessions, 91, 2001, and 2007. When you look at the financial crisis, probably the most severe was 2007 to 2009. Now, what made it more severe was that it was preceded by a massive debt buildup that you saw in the mortgage markets. We saw it in consumer debt. We saw it in derivatives and the real estate bubble, which is why it was so severe. Anytime you have a massive amount of debt, we had inflation overheating because there was a lot of credit that was going into the market with margin debt, going into mergers, going into real estate. And of course, when you have a lot of debt and the Fed's raising interest rates and that credit is flowing into the economy, we had an increase in inflation. We have not seen that in this economic recovery. So what makes where we are today so unique is that we are living during an unusual period of world history. Extraordinary would probably be a better word to describe it. Throughout history, and going back 5,000 years, interest rates have averaged between 6 and 8%. Now, there have been periods when interest rates got higher during periods of war. You can think of World War I. You can think of the Civil War. You can think of the Napoleonic Wars. And throughout history, Roman Wars, the interest rates tend to rise because governments are spending more money on armaments. So you get these occasional what I call interest rate spikes, but then they get back to normal in a range of 6 to 8%. And if you think about Fed funds rate, which is a driving force behind the market, it averaged between 3% and 6%. When we would go into a recession, the Fed would drive interest rates down to 3%. When the economy was heating up, they would drive the Fed funds rate up to 5 or 6%. Here we are today at 1.25%. So if you look at the last 36 years, we've seen in our lifetime the highest interest rates that we have seen in 5,000 years of history, which was 1981, when we got close to 20%, which is where they were in 3000 BC. And then last summer, we got down to the lowest interest rates when interest on, let's say, 10-year treasuries got down to 1.3%. So we are witnessing, on top of that, a massive buildup in debt, not just here in the U.S., and globally. And this was a topic I discussed in an interview we'll be playing shortly during our August recess with Professor Silla. He's at the Stern School of Business, and he has written the additional updates to what I consider to be the Bible on a book on history rates. It's called A History of Interest Rates by Sidney Homer. If you're not familiar with Sidney Homer, he was a senior partner at Salomon Brothers. He wrote the book, A History of Interest Rates, in 1963. Since that period of time, Professor Silla from the Stern School of Business has made four updates. And let's go to that clip from the interview when we talk about this extraordinary period of time.
anyone who's lived through the last, 40 or 50 years can consider himself or herself privileged because you've seen these extreme interest rates of, as you say, 20-21% interest rates back in 1981, and then from 2008, really up to now, very low interest rates, as you say, close to negative in real terms, or sometimes negative in some places in the world. Someone alive today who remembers the last 40 or 50 years can feel that they've been a part of a special period of interest rate history, from the extreme highs to the extreme lows in U.S. history.
That was, once again, a clip from an upcoming interview. We'll have a couple of those clips. It was really a profound interview because, as the professor just made mention there, if you've been around for the last 40 years, you really have lived through extraordinary times. What we've seen since the 1970s leading up to the current period is not normal if you look at 5,000 years of history. And one of the things that I brought up in the interview, if you take a look at U.S. debt, which currently stands at $20 trillion, to put that in perspective, when Reagan left office, it was $1 trillion. And by 2001, the national debt grew fivefold to $5 trillion. That's where it was when George W. Bush took office. At the end of Bush's presidency, the national debt stood at $10 trillion. So basically, Bush doubled the debt. Obama steps in. He inherits $10 trillion of debt, and he leaves office with $20 trillion in debt. So we are seeing a massive amount of debt buildup, something that Professor Silla also brought up.
The national debt was $1 trillion in 1980, 81, around the time Reagan came in. And, just 10, 12 years ago, it was $10 trillion, and now it's $20 trillion. So that one part of the markets you described, the sovereign debt market of governments, has really expanded a great deal in recent decades. It's gone, I don't know whether most Americans are aware that our national debt has gone up by a factor of 20 since about 1980.
Jim, I'm just curious because we've talked a lot about the government debt, which is now at 20 plus trillion and rising. But leading up to the crisis back in 2007, both private consumer and corporate debt were also at record levels. How do they look now if we're approaching another crisis compared to maybe what the national debt is or what they were doing back in 2007?
Well, this is what is making this interesting as we look going forward. Household debt has increased, and it's actually, John, much higher than where it was before the height of the crisis in 2007. In fact, there was just a recent report issued by the New York Fed, and it is now approaching a peak of $12.7 trillion. And that was as of the first quarter of this year. Household debt continues to increase, either on mortgage debt, auto debt, credit card debt. So it's another milestone in this long recovery. But I guess if there's a bright spot when you look at this debt, asset levels have also increased. Real estate is back up to where it was in many parts of the country before the crisis. So that's making everyone's mortgage look better. The stock market is up almost 270%. So everybody's 401k. So even though debt levels increased, what makes it nice is asset levels have increased as well. And so what you always look at when you're heading into a crisis or a possible crisis or recession, where are the outliers? Where are the over-leveraged areas of the economy? Where is the bubble emerging? These are the things that will determine the outcome of what this next storm will look like.
Well, outside of the U.S. debt, any other trouble spots?
Right now I see three possible trouble spots, and we've been seeing more and more stories, not only in the Financial Times, but also Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal. Three trouble spots stand out right now. Number one is auto loans, because auto sales have been setting record levels. Number two, student loans. And number three, short-term corporate debt. Now, let's begin with auto loans. They are up 9%. Year over year as of the first quarter of 2017. And last year was a record year. Americans bought more new cars than any other time in our economic history. Auto loans closed out 2016 just shy of $1.2 trillion. That's 13% above the previous crisis peak which was reached in 2005, and you're going to see, in my opinion, a shrinkage in the auto industry as a result of technology and where trends are going. So American car buying bonanza, which has been fueled by cheap credit. I mean, let's face it. Take a look at what we've been able to borrow. I don't care if you're getting an auto loan, an auto lease, or even getting a mortgage. Car purchases and financing are at record levels, while wages have not risen that much. And the average car loan has risen steadily because people, it's the price of energy, especially when the price of energy came down from over $100 a barrel all the way down to $26 a barrel in February of last year, the American public have been buying bigger and bigger cars, more SUVs. You see them in parking lots. And what does that mean? People are spending more on cars. They're buying more expensive cars because of the cheap financing. And this was one of the things that led to the housing crisis because of the kind of ninja loans and the sucker rate loans that were offered on mortgages in the last decade. Instead of buying houses that people could afford, they stepped up and they bought bigger homes because the financing costs were cheaper. It's the same thing that is taking place in the auto market with cheap financing, with cheap leasing. What has happened, it has enabled car buyers to step up and buy bigger cars, more expensive cars, luxury cars. But here's the good thing. Unlike the mortgage crisis that we saw in the last decade, out of the 1.2 trillion in auto loans, only 97 billion of those have been securitized, because that's where a lot of the mortgage problems took place. Banks didn't care if they made a loan because they packaged them and they securitized them and sold them, got them off their books. But one half of that securitized debt is subprime, and three quarters of those subprime loans are coming from the auto finance companies. In other words, a lot of companies like GM, Ford have finance divisions, just like General Electric did during the financial crisis, financing its jet engines, its trains, and a lot of the big equipment it made. And it's also coming via the car manufacturers and the dealers with aggressive lending to what I call low quality consumers with bad credit. Does that sound familiar, John?
You know, this really does sound like a repeat, Jim, pretty much of what we look at, what happened with the housing market and where it went and how everything fell apart and the build up to it. It's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, nearly one quarter of that 1.2 trillion in auto loans are subprime, approaching close to $300 billion. Now, according to the New York Fed, 6 million American consumers are at least 90 days late on their car loan. So there is trouble brewing in the car market, and it has implications because, as we have seen, as a result of cheap financing, whether you're buying a car and also leases, which means a lease with low interest rates imputed in that lease, people have been able to step up and buy more expensive cars. The problem is these leases come off lease. Let's say you got a 3-year lease or 5-year lease. What does that mean? That car, you turn it into the dealer. Now you have a lot of used cars on the market, and used car prices have been driven down, which ups the chances that borrowers on their cars have negative equity in their cars, meaning that they owe more on their car loan than their actual car worth, given what's happened in the used car market. So what we are now seeing is both auto debt is increased tremendously and is at a record. Delinquencies are running at historically high levels. So at some point in the future, we have a day of reckoning that is coming to the auto sector. And also, the auto sector is going to get hit by technology with driverless cars. And also the fact, just as we've seen it in the hotel industry, we've seen it in, let's say, taxis with Uber, we've seen it in lodging with Airbnb. Actually, they're doing the same thing. You can buy a car, John, and then lease out your car just like Uber or Airbnb to make your car payments. And so this idea where, you know, husband and wife get married, a wife goes to work, husband has a car, wife has a car, they have kids, junior grows up, junior has a car. You're going to see the auto market shrink over the next decade, which has broad implications for the auto industry and auto dealerships. So that is one storm that is on the horizon here. And we're starting to see more and more negativity, either a rise in delinquencies. So that's a possible trouble spot.
Okay, so auto loans are one. One that really pops into my mind is student loans, because we've all heard the discussion about how so many students have gone to college. They have hideous amounts of debt and they can't get jobs that are going to allow them to pay these off. Some people are $100,000 in debt and they're just starting into the job market.
Yeah, the one thing, if we take a look at the beginning of 2017, student loan debt stood at $1.4 trillion. According to the government, 44.2 million Americans have student loans. Now, here's the bad part. Student loan delinquency rate is currently running at 11.2% and rising. That means more than one-tenth of all student loans are in default or 90 days past due. And I mean, some of these things, when you look at some of the statistics, it's quite shocking. Let me just throw out some statistics, and this is from a study on the student loan market. In 2012, 71% of students graduating from four-year colleges had student debt. It represents 1.3 million students graduating with debt, an increase from 1.1 million in 2008. 66% of graduates from public colleges had average loan debt of almost $26,000. 75% of graduates from private nonprofit colleges had an average debt of over $32,000. And 88% of graduates for profit colleges had loans outstanding average of almost $40,000. And also, you know, you've heard about Pell Grants. 88% of graduates who received Pell Grants had an average loan balance of $31,000, and 53% had averages of about $26,000. It gets even worse when you take a look at graduate school. The loans are even higher. About 40% of that $1.2 trillion loans is used to finance graduate or professional degrees, like a doctor or a lawyer. Those that go to graduate school and get an MBA have an average balance of $42,000 in debt. That's about 11% of the students. Those who got a master's in education had an average balance, I'm rounding these numbers off, about $51,000. That's 16%. Those who got master's degree in liberal arts, where they're having difficulty getting jobs, the average debt was about $59,000. That's 8%. Those who went to law school had an average loan balance of $141,000, and those who went into medicine, like doctors, had an average loan balance of $162,000. What's amazing is when you look at these debt levels, those who went into education and art have taken on enormous amounts of debt over the average, let's say, regular degree, in many cases to finance jobs that don't pay as much. In other words, a teacher who may have a large debt balance with a master's degree of $51,000 may get into a job that doesn't pay that much. So that's something that you're taking a look at. And right now, over 11% of these loans are delinquent. And that trend has been rising every single year as the cost of education has been rising as well.
Okay, down to the third possibility, which you did mention in there, and that's corporate debt. And this one gets a little of my interest as to its role.
Well, I mean, corporate debt is at record levels, exceeding those levels reached in the last crisis. And corporate debt hit record levels in 2016 and continues to climb in 2017. Because what did we see in 2017? It was widely expected that interest rates would be rising to 3%. We'll talk in this segment and the next segment of why we still may see interest rates get up to 3%, especially if the Fed starts to shrink its balance sheet as soon as September or October. We'll find out more about that at Jackson Hole. So why some are getting concerned right now in the financial industry is the ratio of debt to corporate earnings usually peaks during economic downturn. Now, why would that take place? What happens in an economic downturn? Corporations have debt on their balance sheet, but their earnings drop. So the debt becomes a higher percentage of corporate earnings because you have a downfall in earnings, especially in an economic recession. You do not see this debt to earnings ratio peak typically in economic expansions like we have now when the economy is doing well. And that's what makes this trend so alarming. And it was something that I was talking to Professor Silla on the history of interest rates, because you've heard technicians on the program here talking about we are in a bottom cycle. In other words, towards the end of a bull market in bonds, and some, like myself, believe that we've started a bear market in bonds, but it may take, there are longer trending things. That was one of the themes that came out in the history of interest rates when it was first published in 1963 and has been updated as recently as 2005. And when I was talking to Professor Silla, I asked him, I said, when's the next update? You know, you haven't updated it. He said, you know what? They have asked me to update it, but I cannot do that because we have not seen a stabilization of monetary policy and interest rates. But let's go to that clip when he talks about one of the themes of the book are these trends in long-term rates.
Well, one of the themes of the book is that based on the past 150 years or so of U.S. history, is that interest rates seem to trend in certain directions for periods of, I would say, from, let's say, 20 to 40 years. So there's like a cycle of interest rates. The trend was down after the U.S. Civil War to about nearly the end of the 19th century, 1898 or so. Then the trend was up for 22 years to about 1920. And then it was down again from 1920 to 1945, then up very sharply in the 1960s and 70s. Interest rates went up to these extreme levels we've already mentioned around 1980, 81. And since 1981, they've been trending down.
So if we're seeing large amounts of corporate debt accumulation, is the corporate sector in trouble?
Well, I guess there's some good news and bad news. Although debt accumulation has been large, much of it has been taking place in a few industries, primarily utilities. Utilities are a very capital-intensive industry. They have huge debt burdens imposed on them because they have all these environmental regulations that they have to, let's say, reduce emissions. And so utilities have been doing that. Material companies like the mining industry is also heavily indebted, as well as the energy industry. Now, if you remove these three industries out of the nine industries that make up the S&P, then the debt ratio on much of the corporate sector is actually looking lower than it was a decade ago. But the trend, John, is, you know, what is more important as you head into a downturn, where is the trend? I mentioned we already see a trend in the auto industry. Delinquencies are rising. Debt levels are rising. We've seen a trend in the student loan market. Debt levels are rising. Default rates are rising. And we're also seeing a trend in corporate financing, because a lot of these corporations that were buying back stock, increasing dividends, a lot of them were doing it with financing debt. And we talked about this a number of years ago, a trend we saw develop in 2013 and 2014. You had companies like Intel or Microsoft or Apple. They were issuing $5 billion worth of bonds, like Intel, at an interest rate of 1.6% over a five-year period, and Intel was buying back its stock, which was paying a dividend of over 4%. So a lot of these companies use this debt accumulation, not just for acquisitions, but to buy back stock and basically increase dividends, because dividends are non-deductible, interest rates are. So if I swap, like Intel did, buying back stock, eliminating dividends, which are non-deductible, to a corporation, and I substitute debt as a corporation, I get to write that debt off on my tax return. And that's one of the things that they've been talking about when they refer to tax reform, lowering tax rates, but getting rid of the incentives to issue a lot of debt, which I think would make the corporate sector a lot healthier. But the trend is up for two-thirds of the companies in the Dow Jones Industrials have higher debt ratios this year than they did last year, and had higher debt last year than they did before. Now, here's the problem, is the Fed is raising interest rates, and there's about $2 trillion of U.S. corporate debt that is coming due in the next 5 years. Now, that could become challenging for companies with high debt loads, including areas like telecom and energy. One reason that the oil market has been a little bit more resilient, especially shale oil companies, they had to keep pumping oil because they had debt service payments. And because of low interest rates, banks and the securities market has allowed a lot of these companies to refinance that debt but it's short term. So that's a key sector to watch, especially those companies that are highly leveraged, because 75% of those companies with debt coming due, and here's the good news about the corporate sector, 75% of those companies have either stable earnings or strong balance sheet. The problem is short-term collateralized debt loans that were issued before 2017 by themselves. Some of these companies, the assets won't be sufficient and the income to cover a lot of the speculative grade loans, and the refunding is going to be coming due from now until the end of this decade in 2020. There's about $400 billion there that's coming due, and that's one area that could become a real problem, especially for these low-quality credits. They just simply won't have the earnings, the cash, or a strong enough balance sheet to weather rising interest rates.
Yeah, you can see this collision of trends. In other words, this debt's coming due, the Fed is raising interest rates. And so what are the implications then if we see higher rates and rollovers of debts that are due?
Well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why you've seen this increase in debt. As I just mentioned, two-thirds of the Dow industrial companies have greater debt in 2017 than they had in 2016, and greater debt in 2016 than 2015. What do these companies know? If you're a treasurer at a large company, you know the Fed is raising interest rates. What does that mean? Short-term debt from commercial paper to even short-term funding is going to get more expensive. So a lot of these companies have been rushing into the market, especially in 2017. We've seen record amounts of corporate debt issuance. The reason they're doing that is instead of interest rates going up, interest rates actually came down because the spread between U.S. treasuries and interest rates, let's say in Europe, have widened considerably. So a lot of European money is coming in here and has kept long-term interest rates down, allowing these companies to refinance. And that's why there's a rush and there's such a great debt buildup in the corporate sector in 2017. But if you take a look at what the smart money is doing, you take the large bond fund managers like PIMCO, DoubleLine, or BlackRock, they're all increasing their debt quality, meaning they're getting and shedding their low-quality credit, junk bonds, and they're upgrading their credit on the corporate side and also with sovereigns. In other words, they're shedding risk. And the unfortunate thing is the public is moving into high-risk credit, and they don't even realize it in the ETFs and some of the bonds that they're buying or bond funds. Because the public tends to chase, as they're doing today, index funds, and they're chasing yield. So if you're a retiree and you're looking at two bond funds, one pays 3%, the other one pays 4%, you're probably choosing the 4% or the 4 or 5% bond fund, not realizing you are taking on enormous amounts of credit risk as the Fed is raising interest rates, as the business cycle ages, and as credit quality deteriorates on many of these companies who may run into refunding risk as these short-term bonds come due. So as the Fed raises interest rates, the cost of debt will increase along with recession risk. So, John, those are some of the storm fronts that we see. There are a couple other things we need to get to here as well.
Okay, so yeah. If we're talking about other than an outside asset bubble, the real three problematical areas then are auto loans, student loans, and short-term, low-quality corporate debt. And, you know, you'll hear some counter to these arguments, but first of all, debt levels at government level, corporate or individual level, they're higher today than leading into the last financial storm. And, you know, people will say, well, debt levels have come down, but it's only if you look at them in terms of a ratio because asset levels have risen. But we all know that as soon as you hit a downturn, the asset levels start to come down.
Yeah, and it's one issue that is concerned a lot of people. And that's why you are seeing, you know, the smart money is upgrading quality, whether it's stock holdings, whether it's bond holdings, because, you know, the one thing about a Fed rate raising cycle, what is the Fed telling us? They're going to keep raising interest rates. What does that tell us? They'll keep raising. And according to history, they keep raising until they break something, usually the economy and the markets. And the first thing to break will be the markets. But I think we're a bit a ways from that yet because we are starting at such historical low levels. Remember, in 2004, Greenspan began raising interest rates when the Fed funds rate was at 1%. Well, Yellen started raising interest rates when the Fed funds rate was at zero. So we're only at 1.25. But I do believe, as a result of record government debt, corporate debt, and individual debt, that the Fed funds rate will be much lower than the Fed is projecting. I just don't see it, John, getting up over 2.5 or even 2%, and may only get up to 1.75 or 2% before the damage is done. So the other thing besides the debt levels we also have to talk about is when you go into a recession or downturn, what are the levels of assets? Well, we know this is the second most expensive market in history. The first one was the tech bubble in the year 2000. So the other bubble that is developing, as we have talked about and some of our experts have talked about, I've got an interview coming up in the month of August with an expert that gets into this very issue of the index passive bubble that's taking place in the market. And that's what's driving up these astronomical prices that we're seeing in valuations of the FANG stocks.
Okay, well, there's the scenario framing it all, but now my curiosity is piqued. When it starts to unfold, how does it do? What's the pattern?
Well, I mean, right now, the big worry for the markets is deflation and worries with dropping energy prices, which have led to a downturn in the CPI. And if you look at last year, when CPI was trending up, what happened last year? The price of energy doubled from $26 to $50. And so that led to a flow through in inflation in the economy. What has happened since after first quarter? The price of oil has dipped down back into bear market territory. It's probably in the mid 40s right now. And so the one perception by the markets that I think could be the big surprise towards the end of the year is oil prices rise much more than is anticipated. The other thing is low interest rates could start to rise. And the reason that can happen is the Fed begins to shrink its balance sheet. As the ECB begins to taper, meaning they're buying less bonds, what you're having are two massive buyers exiting the bond market, which has suppressed the level of interest rates. Just as QE, both at the ECB and the Fed, have driven down interest rates to historical low levels, what happens when that QE comes to an end and central banks start tightening, interest rates could start to rise. So the real key is to watch the reflation trade, whether it fails or it takes place by the end of the year, because typically the fourth quarter has been a strong area for a reflation trade. Think 2016 with the big rise in energy over almost $55 a barrel, the energy stocks being the number one performer. So even though the Fed funds rate is only at 1.25%, it's higher than most people think. And there's something that was published by the Atlanta Fed. It was called the shadow funds rate, which takes the interest rate less the deflationary effects. And it was a negative 3%, which it reached in May of 2014. Well, if you take a negative 3% and you go all the way up to 1.25, in reality, the Fed has tightened in interest rates by comparison are over 4%. So we're likely to get one more rate hike this year, which the Fed has given no indication that they are even thinking of reversing from. We know that the Fed is going to start shrinking its balance sheet. And we also know that they're still projecting that they're going to raise interest rates 3 times next year. I just don't think they'll be able to do it unless we get a massive tax cut that spurs the economy and credit that could drive the market and the economy next year. So the real key thing for the reflation trade is watch what's happening, because this is the misperception that we see in the market is the underperformance of financials and energy stocks. They've been terrible. And if you take a look at, however, and look closely within the S&P itself at earnings per share, almost half of the increase in earnings per share is coming from the financial and the energy sector. The energy companies, the large companies, I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Chevron, Royal Dutch, are making large amounts of money, which is contributing to that increase in earnings. The second thing we have going right now is the U.S. economy is entering its strongest period of the year, the second and third quarter. It's also growing at over 2%. At the same time, Global GDP is improving in Europe, in Asia, in Japan. Japan just had one of its best economic quarters for economic growth. So as inventories, the other thing that also continues to drop, inventory levels in the U.S. are continuing to drop. Saudi Arabia now is cutting back massively exports of oil to the U.S. because they know that we're pumping enough. And if they just keep exporting more to the U.S., that's going to keep those inventories elevated and that will drive prices. So inventories are dropping. So energy could pick up in the fourth quarter. If it does, inflation should rise. And as the balance sheet of the Fed begins to contract, interest rates will start to rise. So two things to watch out for as we head into the fall are the reflation trade, rising energy prices, maybe with the possible tax cuts, all of that equals reflation.
So that's a description of the storm front. Now, as far as time of arrival, are we looking at any foreshocks or I forget what they call it in storms, you know, ahead of the front? Or are we pushing things out more towards 2018, 2019?
I think the slowing of the economy and the peaking of the market is more of a 2018 story. We could get a massive reflation trade or a big reflation trade towards the end of this year leading into next year. I think we're still going to get one more rate hike this year leading into the year, so we could end up the year at Fed funds rate at 1.5%. And then, John, I think it's going to be, you know, how far this economic expansion extends. Really, at that point, will be resting on two factors. Number one, do the Republicans actually get a tax cut through? Because that will be stimulative to the economy. Number two, does the Fed continue to raise interest rates and cut back on its balance sheet, which could help raise interest rates, which would improve the lending margins for banks to lend more money? That could extend this till the end of 2018 with a possible recession in 2019. If we don't get that, if the Fed stops raising interest rates, doesn't cut back as much because the economy weakens, and we don't get the reflation trade, then we could be talking about a recession sometime in 2018. But before the recession, the market will peak because the market is a leading indicator. So remember the sort of sequence scenario. The bond market peaks first, the stock market peaks second, and the commodity market peaks third. So that's why we're watching this reflation trade and watching the Fed. And those are the key things that you need to be watching as we head into the end of this year.
So right now, Jim, we have an expansion of debt that is bigger than it was prior to the last kaboom back in 2007. We can clearly see that storm fronts are developing in the auto debt, in student debt, and also in short-term corporate bonds. We've reiterated that during this segment. Debt levels are at record highs, and so is the stock market, and we have a bubble in index funds, which is growing. So there it is. There's your precursor to the storm. Next segment, what does this mean for investors? Is the Financial Sense News Hour continues with the big picture here at financialsense.com.
I'm Jim Poplava. With the stock market at record levels and the Fed raising interest rates, join me and my staff of experts at my upcoming Wealth Preservation Seminar, which will be held in San Diego on October 21st. We're going to cover the economy, the possibility of a recession and bear market, and what signs to look for that this economic market cycle is coming to an end. More importantly, strategies you can use to protect yourself and your family. Make your reservations today, as there will be limited seating for this special event. Call 888-486-3939 to make your reservations today. Once again, that is 888-486-3939. Call now.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
So the Fed has told us that they've printed this schedule of how much they're going to allow their assets to shrink by $1 trillion by the end of 2019. Well, is that really going to happen? I really don't think that it will, because once the financial markets really begin to understand how extreme this kind of monetary tightening would be, they are probably going to panic, and we'll see a significant drop in the U.S. stock market, for instance. So if the U.S. stock market begins to fall by 10%, then I think the Fed is going to pause the quantitative tightening. And if the markets were really to panic and to fall as much as 20%, I think the Fed would then very aggressively launch a fourth round of quantitative easing. They would once again start printing money and buying financial assets to push the market back up. Because like it or hate it, in the 21st century, the governments, through the central banks primarily, are managing the economy. They're managing it by causing credit to expand and by causing asset prices to inflate. So the Fed couldn't just sit back and watch the stock market crash without doing anything about it, because that would throw the U.S. into severe recession. So that's a more probable scenario. This quantitative tightening will be something akin to the Fed tapping on the brakes, because at the moment, the stock market is really becoming very overheated. The Fed wants the market to go up, but probably something in the range of 5% a year. It's already gone up more than 10% this year. So that's excessive. The Fed would be concerned that there's going to be another bubble that blows up and causes a systemic crisis again. So they don't want that. So they need to slow things down a bit. And that's probably what all this talk about quantitative tightening is really about.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. When the economy enters a recession, which it is going to do, of course, it's followed by a bear market in stocks, that takes place usually as the result of a Fed rate raising cycle. And every technician, including Craig Johnson, whom we had on this week, we're talking about if 10-year Treasury yields fall below 2%. If you look at that, that will be one indicator. Washington dysfunction, where is this going to head? Of course, Washington dysfunction is coupled with media dysfunction and also the breakdown of the dollar. Those three things are probably harbingers of the storm that would be coming. Now, let's assume that it does come. Cycles come and go. What should you be doing ahead of the storm, and where should you be afterwards? What will it look like after the storm has struck?
You know, John, as Craig Johnson was talking about, you know, he's been probably one of the more bullish technicians that we had. And Craig, to his credit, was very bullish at times when, like in 2015 and 2011, when the markets were looking pretty shaky and people were talking about, you know, maybe this was it and it was over. But what we don't know at this point, will Washington get anything done? We had the resignation of another Trump advisor on Friday. We haven't had Obamacare repeal. There's even questions now whether they can get tax reform done before the end of the year, because when they come back on Labor Day, the first thing they're going to have to do is get the budget. The government's fiscal year ends September 30th. In this budget that will be formulated for going into 2018, which begins October 1st, will be the president's first budget as president, because the budget for 2017 was Obama's budget that was put into effect in October of 2016. So we don't know that at this point. Secondly, what we don't also know is, will the Fed make another mistake? They already plan to raise interest rates another quarter of a point. That could come in November meeting or the December meeting. And they're also going to start pulling back and shrinking their balance sheet. Now, they haven't done this before. So if we start seeing the LAI start to roll over, economic growth weaken, if they continue to proceed, because they're always looking through the rearview mirror, they could over-tighten at a time we don't need to be tightening. So either one of those or both could cause the stock market to top, not to mention troubles in China's over debt-laden economy. So it's really kind of a function of a couple variables in terms of how this thing gets extended out into next year. Craig Johnson, our technician, is very optimistic that that will happen. But, you know, look how many times, folks, over the last 4 or 5 years has the Fed had to retract what it planned on doing, whether it was raising rates, when it was going to start taper, or what happened when they did start taper. And don't forget, the European Central Bank is thinking about starting taper itself. This reminds me, there's a cartoon I'm trying to think who the cartoonist was. It was a cartoon showing the history of the Fed funds rate with the height of the Fed chairman. Now, John, you're going to find this hilarious. Paul Volcker, he was 6'7" tall. The guy was huge. Greenspan was 5'11" tall. Bernanke was 5'8" tall. And Janet Yellen is 5 feet. Folks, we're in real trouble if the next Fed chairman appointed by the president is under 5 feet. We could be heading for a serious deflation. I mean, somebody had to have a real good sense of humor. And they traced the Fed funds rate falling since 1981, and then they traced it with the height of each chairman. I mean, I don't think people realized how big of a man Paul Volcker was. I mean, 6'7". My goodness, he could have played basketball. Maybe he did.
Okay, getting back to the future then, Jim. Aside from the heights of Federal Reserve chair people, what should you be looking for and what preparations should you be making? You know, you see a storm coming, you take what actions are required ahead of time.
Well, I mean, the one thing that we've been talking about is the reflation trade, and we talked about that with Frank Holmes, and we're getting back to, you know, what is going to happen to oil, gold, and the reflation trade? You're not going to have a reflation trade if you don't have oil rising. So what do we do know about oil right now? Inventories consistently continue to drop. Demand is increasing, and there are very strong incentives for the Saudis to keep prices elevated in the $50 to $60 range for their IPO of Aramco, which will be the biggest IPO in history. So there are a lot of incentives. They've cut back on inventories by almost 300,000 barrels a day, and that's helping these inventories drop. So moving forward, if we see oil dropping along with commodities, that's alerting us that we may be coming to the end of the cycle. Because remember the sequence we talked about in the last segment. Bonds peak first because the Fed's raising interest rates. Stocks peak next. And finally, commodities. So if we are to travel along a typical pattern, we should begin to see commodities pick up in the fall, as we're seeing in gold, as we're seeing in copper. We need to see it in oil. The other thing that we need to watch is what happens to 10-year yields. At the beginning of the year, they are projected to go up to 3. Craig thinks they can hit 2.75. But if they drop below 2%, that would be a warning. And the other thing that we're watching is widening credit spreads. That's the difference between quality bonds and junk bonds. And right now, it's narrowing. But if they start to widen, that it would be an alert that there's trouble ahead of us. And so all of those things, John, are things that we're trying to watch and see what develops. So keep your eyes on oil in the reflation trade, gold heading into the fall as we come back after Labor Day.
Well, assuming that we have another downturn due to the Fed raising interest rates, what happens after that?
The Fed funds futures, they're talking about the Fed funds rate gets in anywhere from 2.25 to 2.5. I seriously doubt if they get over 2%. Maybe we top out at 2%. I just don't see 2.25 or 2.5. I just don't think we'll get that high. What will the Fed do if we get into a recession? They'll do what they always do. They'll begin dropping the Fed funds rate, but they're going to be dropping it from a lower rate. We'll be back down to a zero Fed funds rate. And I assume, like last time, with not too many bullets in the chamber, they're going to resort to quantitative easing again. So the rates of return going forward for investors are not going to be that great, especially in bonds, because interest rates, I mean, right now on sovereigns, they're 2% here. They're 1% or less overseas and 0.5% or less over Japan. And especially if we go into a recession, what happens? Bond prices get elevated because people switch out of stocks. They go into bonds, driving prices up, which drives the yields down. So the next downturn, I would say look for a powerful combination of low interest rates combined with what President Obama did in 2009 with fiscal spending. So this time, however, hopefully it'll get done with infrastructure spending, because the infrastructure, I don't know what it's like where you're at, John, but right here in California, you see potholes, bridges are in disrepair, airports. I mean, it's really a shame to see what's happened to the state. When I first moved here in 1982, in terms of looking at its infrastructure, its dams are in danger. We don't have enough power plants. We don't have enough desalination plants. I mean, there are a lot of things. And so there is this need for infrastructure. So just like in 2009, what did Obama do? The first thing he did is he passed, what, an $8 trillion spending bill. The Fed announced not only were we at 0% interest rates, but they announced QE1, which was $1.2 trillion. So I would look for a powerful combination of a drop in interest rates and huge fiscal spending.
Yeah, but when we did see the Fed do that back in, what, 2009, interest rates were fairly high.
They were fairly high, but also one of the things the Fed can do with QE, could essentially monetize the federal debt and use a policy of financial repression as it did in the 50s and as it did in the last decade on the economic recovery coming out of 2009. The Fed kept interest rates artificially low by buying bonds on the long end. And eventually what they did is they drove long rates down, which also drove borrowing rates from car loans to mortgage rates down. So they could do the same thing. You also have another element that we haven't had. Well, it's been here, but it's accelerating, and that's technology, which is lowering not only manufacturing cost as robots take over manufacturing, but John, it's also moving into the service area, so that could put a restraint on inflation. The only inflation that we're really seeing right now are in government monopolies. We're seeing it in education. And we're seeing it in healthcare as a result of Obamacare. But technology is driving down the cost of goods. I mean, take a look at, I was in Costco the other day and there was a 40-inch 4K TV. It was like $400 when 4K TVs first came out, or plasma TVs. I remember the first 40-inch plasma TV that came out, it was $7,000. Now a 40-incher is under $400. So technology is also going to be a driving force. You also have something that is, I think, going to be very restrictive. In other words, I think 2% economic growth is the new medium. Forget the talk about 3 and 4% growth rates, but it's glowing populism. It's not just here in the U.S., but Trump, you saw it in England, you're seeing it in Europe. That's still with us, which is really another form of reverse globalization. So you're going to see slower growth worldwide. I have a client who runs a chain of fast food burger restaurants, and as the minimum wages have risen, he's automating most of his restaurants, and he's getting to the point where they're installing kiosks. So instead of walking up to a counter and talking to a person or several people making your order, you'll just walk into a kiosk, type in, you know, I want a burger with fries and a Coke or whatever you're going to order. You punch it. It goes directly to the back room where there is an automated machine. You'll have a gentleman that will load the burgers into machines. So it's, the burgers are cooked automatically. It's only when it comes out of the machine cooked that you have to have somebody that assembles it with whatever you want, whether it's cheese or whatever condiments that you want on your burger, and then package it, hands it to the person up front and gives it to you. And he says he will be able to reduce his payroll by almost 60% or more over the next couple of years. You're also going to see the same thing take place in retail, where the stores of the future, we did a show on this a while back, where you're going to see a sharp drop off, not only in the number of retail stores, but also their size. You're going to walk in, instead of a store full of displays with all the clothing laid out, you're going to walk in and you're going to see a, like a kiosk with a large TV. You will scroll through it. Maybe you have one person that helps you. You will pick what it is that you like, and then you'll go into a high-tech dressing room. You press a button and you will see whatever you're buying, whether it's a blouse, a shirt, a pair of pants on you. So all of this is going high-tech, which means fewer cooks in restaurants. You're going to see fewer people in retail. And automation is also even going to hit the white-collar workforce. Anything that is routine will be automated. So the implication of all of this is going forward is you're going to be seeing lower returns.
So what we are watching here then is both the reflation trade and the bond market. And then what are we watching for immediately prior to the storm, and what do you do?
Well, there's two things. As we talked in the last segment, even the big bond managers right now, we talked about some of the problems with student loans, auto loans, and short-term corporate credits. So you're seeing everybody from PIMCO to BlackRock to Double Line moving into higher quality credits. You do not want to be in junk bonds. I think that you're just taking a lot of risk. Short-term bonds, interest rate floaters is something that you could use and still participate. As the Fed raises interest rates, your rates actually go up. So you're protected. And also you want to be into quality, especially at some point. I don't know if it's the end of the year or it's going to be the end of next year that we really see this weakness. As I said, it's going to depend on two things. It's going to depend on what actually happens in Washington, if they actually get anything done like a tax cut, or if the Fed makes a major policy mistake and gets aggressive, which they're prone to do 95% of the time they crash the airplane. So after that, I think, you know, your rate of returns following the downturn will depend on how active you manage your portfolio. If you're fully invested in stocks during the downturn, it's going to take you years to recoup, just as it did. If you lost money between 2007 and 2009, you didn't recover until 2013. However, if you are active, then your rate of return coming out of a storm is really to the extent of how low stock prices get down. I mean, they were at over 1,500 in October of 2007, and they got down to 666 in March of 2009. So here we are approaching 2,500. So it depends on how big of a downturn. Usually bear markets are 30 to 40% downturn in stocks. So that could really be hitting a lot of the passive index funds. And so typical bull markets, 30 to 40%. The last one was closer to 60% and similar to the one in 2000. But what we had is we had two big bubbles. So passive investing, I predict, will be proven or be out of favor. Active investing will be coming into a foe. You're seeing it start to happen now. So a lot of what happens is to some extent the degree of the damage done in the bear market. But look for when we come out of it, you're going to see massive fiscal stimulus on infrastructure. The Fed will lower interest rates. You're going to see a return to quantitative easing, but you will see slower economic growth. If there's going to be inflation, it's going to be inflation in government-denominated sectors of the economy, education, and healthcare, where we're seeing the highest rates of inflation. And the third area of inflation will be in assets.
So what we're watching here, just so everybody, we can reiterate it a bit here for people, we're watching the reflation trade, the bond market, and now the real thing you have to do watch in reflation trade, what will Washington do? What will the Fed do? Those are the real three core things. The actions you can take in anticipation of that, improve the quality of your credit. Don't be afraid to take some profits off the table as the stock market goes higher. But there is going to come a time in the not distant future when you're going to have to be defensive and you're going to have to recognize when to do that. And that's what we will be here to do. Now, what's going to come up in the next couple of weeks? We take 2 weeks off at the end of August, but that doesn't mean there is no show. It just means we do special shows that are different than the normal ones. And of course, we always hold our breath when we do that and say, we sure hope nothing blows up in the market, which on a number of occasions it has, in which event we will come back and do special programs to deal with that. Anyway, Jim, what are we looking forward to as we bump into the fall here now in 2017?
I think as we bump into the fall, the two things that will be happening in September, will Congress be able to function and come up? Because we get to the debt ceiling debate. The president has to submit and approve a budget for fiscal year 2018. This will be the president's first budget because the 2017 budget was an Obama budget. So the debt ceiling debate and also Trump's budget, that'll be coming up in the month of September. So, you know, forget tax cuts. I doubt if they're going to have time to even talk about that. We'll also be looking at what the Fed is going to do, when it'll start shrinking its balance sheet. And of course, September, we also look at towards the end of the month of what's going to happen with corporate earnings. We're going to be watching the reflation trade. So, John, we will have no shortage of things to talk about when we get back from vacation, keeping our fingers crossed. We have a nice, peaceful end of the summer. But while we're gone, we have just put together really super interviews. We've got four coming one that we're going to do next week with Ned Davis. Also, we are going to be interviewing Professor Silla. He is from Stern School of Business, and he has done the updates to a history of interest rates originally written in 1963 by Solomon partner Sidney Homer. Boy, are you going to want to listen to this interview. It is absolutely fascinating, and it was nice to have him validate a thought that we've had here on the show, that if you've been around the last 40 years, you have lived through the most interesting period in human history when it comes to interest rates. So a lot of great interviews while we're gone. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant rest of the summer. We'll see you when we come back.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.